Thank you, Keith. I'll now ask for contributions, questions. Anyone have something to ask the speaker?
Go on, you can decide.
Do you hear anything?
No.
I hear nothing.
Go on, anyone. Adam. Yeah?
Austria. What happened to him during the war?
He was anti-war.
No, what happened to him? As an enemy alien.
Did he get impounded?
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid I can't say that, can you? I don't know whether he was impounded or not. I think he possibly was. In fact, you're asking me to go back to things. The Rudolf Rocker biography I read more than 20 years ago. Was he impounded? Yes, he was. He was impounded and he was deported. There you go. So I did know the answer to that one.
Anyone else?
Jacqueline, you must have something to say.
I've got plenty to say, but I want to give the audience a chance. First of all, the owner of the Clarion.
Yeah.
Because I've got a bit of interest in this myself.
Yeah.
But I understand it was Hyman.
No. Clarion was owned by Robert Blatchford. Let's go.
I beg your pardon, Robert Blatchford. Now, he was an industrialist.
No,
I'm thinking of Hyman. Sorry. Let me take you back to Hyman.
Yeah, Hyman.
Can't remember the party.
The British Socialist Party.
The British Socialist Party, that was it.
Formerly the Social
Party. Owned Justice Magazine, am I right?
He did, yes.
And he actually owned it, so wasn't
he
an industrialist?
He didn't own it completely.
Let me ask a quick question.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, go on. Ask the question.
What I'm asking is, he was what we would call a member of the capitalist class,
yes,
today.
He was, yes.
A minor member, mind you. Sorry?
He had money,
what we call the capitalist,
yes,
half, and he took that printing press with him when he left in the dire things. But he was autocratic,
yeah,
wanted to be a leader, and wanted the members to be his own pamphlets, if I understand.
Yeah.
And of course there were members there called the Impossibilists, who are now the Socialist Party of Great Britain, forerunners, who were all against that. Can you tell us a bit about that, please? A bit about what was going on then?
Well, I think I pretty much summed it up by saying that there's a question of democracy here. That was one of the principal reasons why we left the SDF, which was a forerunner, the Social Democratic Federation. One of the main reasons was, because they were anti-democratic, they were associating with through Hindman, he was their leader, I suppose you'd call it. He made a lot of the decisions. They were associating with non-socialists. They were trying to do all these different things, and they were trying to do they were reformists and they were anti-democratic. There was a lot of other things that were going on, but I would say mostly it was because we were part of the Marxist revival. We were Marxists. We were reacting against that old sort of ways of doing things. We were class people. We were the class men of the time. That was our reason for existence. That's what Marxism is all about. It's about the working class. It's about understanding the class position. Whereas I think people like Hindman, they didn't really know what socialism was. They didn't really understand the class position. They weren't really interested in it. They were equivocating and things like that. And he was, as you say, he was an industrialist. He was actually, he wasn't just a minor member, he was a director of companies.
Wow.
It's always said this about William Morris, and I thought, oh yes, he's...
But he was a socialist.
He was a socialist, but actually he apparently, I've been told, you're a member of the William Morris Society, Adam, so you'll be able to tell us...
It's too tweet for me.
Did he give up his directorships when he became a socialist? He certainly gave up his top hat and his tails. Did he also give up his directorships?
I can't remember whether it was him or Engels who sat on his top hat.
It was William Morris. William Morris sat on his top hat. This is one of the big legends about what you're actually supposed to do if you're a member of the capitalist class and you see this is a good thing, the socialism, whatever, for whatever reason, you're supposed to essentially give up your higher positions. You can take the money by all means, but the actual controlling bit of it and lifestyle, you really should really give that up.
William
you shouldn't
Morris
have a top hat and tail.
To talk to his associates in his lectures. I've done a bit of reading on him. He actually wanted to put the view across that what they were doing, that he was making beautiful things for such swinish rich people.
Like me.
And, you know, he was a socialist. That's all I think.
What, William Morris?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I say one other thing, Keith?
Yeah.
Keith, one of the loveliest talks I've ever heard on the left. I think you've done really well and I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
And I'd like to hear this talk again.
Was it scathing enough for you?
Quite.
Keith. Some members or non-members who are focused or interested in social might pose the question why the members who became broke away from the SDF, why they actually joined it in the first place?
Because there was no alternative.
Yeah, but I mean, I wonder why they didn't. Well, I mean, see, I don't know when all these members who broke away and formed the party.
Right.
They obviously didn't all join at the same time.
No.
Must have been given age group. I don't know how many there were actually who joined it and then broke away. But you think if they could see these organisations of the SDF and others suspect, I wonder why they didn't see it immediately.
Well, one reason was because there was something called the Marxist Revival. And this was something that was going on in the very early days of the 20th century. It was something that was actually... It was my old friend Daniel De Leon. Let's have a look at him again. He was not just into... Get him up. There he is. Daniel De Leon, he was one of the sort of people who was pushing this Marxist revival. He wasn't just into the socialist industrial unionism. He was one of the people who was pushing the idea that you do not need reforms. You do not need an immediate programme. You can go. All you have to do is you have to be, you know, put forward the socialist case. You don't need these stepping stones to socialism. You don't need them as like lures to attract people in. You know, you can just go straight for it, which is what we did. So there was one thing is that these ideas hadn't been in circulation before that time. So people who were fairly well-established members of the SDF, they would be coming across new ideas, yeah? So it could be said, why didn't they immediately split off? And I think the answer is they wanted the ability to work within the SDF to put forward the case, to put forward the socialist case. They had a journal ready-made. They thought that they could convert everyone. They could not see the fact that there was resistance to it and that some people, in fact, didn't really understand what socialism was at all. They thought, I'm sure that people like Hindman and things like that, I'm sure that they were still on the socialism equals nationalisation kick. And a lot of them were. And I don't think they really saw, because you didn't talk about socialism in quite the same way as you do, as we do today. So I think that's... Basically, I think it's new ideas coming to the fore. And the other thing is I think they wanted to use the SDF as a vehicle to put forward and to actually make the SDF a proper socialist organisation. Does that cover it?
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say it's part of the talk, really? Because you're talking about the left in this country, but would you say it's basically the same... As you know, what you call the left, the German party, SPD, Socialist Party of Deutschland. I mean, that was an enormous party.
It was huge, yes.
It produced about more than one paper every day, newspaper. And they used to get a lot of votes. Of course, they weren't all genuine socialist votes, but they were socialistic, I suppose. But I mean, they fell down in the main. Other than a few individuals like Rosa Luxemburg, probably, and a few others, when it actually came to the front.
Oh, yes, definitely, yeah. I mean, so I suppose you could widen it out here and see that this is actually, you know, the British left is, like I say, very limited. I did say it was limited and quite small. But you can see it as a reflection of what's going on in the sort of wider world, especially in regard to the BSP and the British Socialist Party. They were like the German Social Democrats. They were taking the same view, is that
oh, we can become part of the state here. We can actually get real power to do what we want to do. And, you know, there was that spread from abroad, from the German party to the British Social Democrats. But, yeah, I think that there is reflections of what was going on in Europe and the world within Britain. But I think one of the things is that being quite small, they were quite idiosyncratic as well, because they had more individualistic views than the German Social Democratic Party. And, of course, that split in the same way that our Social Democrats split. They went into a pro-war and anti-war factions, but their anti-war faction was much, much smaller. I mean, the Spartacist group and Rosa Luxemburg, like you said, they were very small compared to the overall German Social Democratic Party, which is quite interesting, an interesting contrast.
Yeah. What action did the government take with these organisations who put forward the anti-war programme? Were they subjected to these sort of official acts at the time?
Well, this is what our exhibition is all about. A little plug there. Basically, to start with, I think it was more the opposition to socialists and anti-war case was more done by the people themselves, because there was a lot of enthusiasm for the war, and we came in for a lot of stick to start off with, because I should say from just basically the populace did not like anti-war people. Our meetings were broken up, and I think this is, we are probably fairly typical, I don't like to say of the left, because that's associating us with them, but there's a similarity there. And I think, first of all, it would be from people themselves. The state didn't need to. As the war went on, I think people's enthusiasm for the war diminished a bit, probably when they were getting pieces of people coming back home. So, you know, they were, people weren't as enthusiastic for the war, and the state stepped in because it wanted this war, and, you know, it was enthusiastic because it saw the rewards for it. The capitalist class through the state, I should say. And then it started to be much more state oppression through the police, and, there was, if you published, like the SLP did, if you published anti-war stuff, you got your premises broken into, you got your press destroyed, you got people arrested. It happened to us, but on a very small basis, because come 1918, which was when the worst depression was going on, we stood back a bit and said, well, no, actually, we're not really sure if we want to really be part of this anti-war crusade. We're socialists. We're socialists before we're anti-war people. You know, we're going to push socialism rather than the anti-war cause. If it's really going to get us that much hassle, if the police are going to come in every day and arrest people. And, they did arrest people. They arrested Jack Fitzgerald, who was one of our founders. And, they went for it in a big state way. But that was after the war had been going a bit, and they could not rely on people themselves taking it out on us. Is that a fair answer? Cool.
Well, we come for the second question. Can I ask you to contribute to the costs of the meeting? It's not compulsory.
But you're not
all the nations gratefully receive. Thank you very much. Does anyone else have a question, points to make?
Adam.
Four members of the Liberal government resigned because they didn't agree with the end of the war. So there were sections of the capitalist class that were against the war. But of course, like the Liberal Party adopted was the Iraq war. Once our boys are fighting, then you don't criticise them, which I think was the position of some of these people in the ILP, the Labour Party, and so on. So there was. There's socialist options of all that you're talking about. There's also opposition on. It's not our war. Let them fight out themselves.
This chap here, isn't that the Norman?
Sir Norman.
But one of the Liberal cabinet ministers to resign was John Burns, who'd been a member of the Social Democratic Federation, a famous man with the red flag in the Dockers strike. But he was the first working man to become a cabinet minister. So he sort of slightly saved it by opposing the war.
Did he? I thought Burns was actually for the war.
Yeah. He was one of the four who resigned. I mean, he wouldn't have opposed recruitment. But the other was Lord Morley and Lord this and that.
Listen, I was just going to point out that Norman Angell, who issued this leaflet, or flyer, if you like, he was also a Liberal. He was a Liberal who defected from the Liberal Party, or from adhering to the Liberal Party, and was looking for somewhere else to go, and he actually ended up in the ILP. Although his views here are clearly not even leftist. They're not leftist views.
Didn't half the Liberal Party Liberal MPs come from the Liberal Party later on?
Jacqueline?
Yeah, Keith, the Socialist Party, the SPGB, Socialist Party of Great Britain, was formed in 1904, June, and the Labour Party was formed in 1906 of that year. I beg your pardon, no?
I think it was seven.
Then you better change your publication here, because I
get
my facts from the history of
Carry on, is that it? No, carry on.
Well, what I was going to say is, and I've read it in there, 1906,
yeah.
2 years before the Socialist Party was formed,
yeah.
2 years before the Labour Party was formed, the Socialist Party was about. Why did these people who professed to have, and I've just never understood this, professed to have socialist inclinations, do other groups or go somewhere else rather than coming to the Socialist Party? What was it about the Socialist Party that put people off? Or what was happening there?
Just one very pedantic point about the Labour Party is that although it adopted the name Labour Party, as a party in 1906, it actually was formed in 1900 because it was the Labour Representation Committee. And 1906 was just a name change. There was nothing else different about it except the name. And basically it was a parliamentary grouping, essentially, of people who had defected from the Liberal Party, which wasn't doing enough for the trade unions. But what was the next point?
Well, I can't understand why they didn't join the Socialist Party. They wanted socialism.
They didn't want socialism.
Right, if you like, this is my chance to say, actually, they weren't class conscious people. That's why they didn't join. We only take class conscious people in those days too. We're looking for people with a class position. If they didn't have it, they're not welcome, Sonny.
Understood.
I don't mean you say they're not class conscious. I mean, they're very active in trade unions, aren't they? I don't think you can just write them off like that. I mean, was it partly that the party wasn't even known in some parts of the country?
Is
that possible, or...?
Mm. Yeah.
Right now. That is possible.
The Labour Party didn't claim to be a socialist party.
Oh, they had.
No, they didn't.
Apologies.
They did later.
Well, at the time, they were claimed to be a Labour Party, a trade union party. Yeah. I mean, the ILP, which was part of the Labour Party, claimed to be socialist. And the Fabians claimed to be. The Labour Party itself didn't claim to be a socialist party. It didn't seek votes or membership on that basis. It was just a question of getting trade union MPs. I think, with their bums on the seats in the House of Commons, that's what they were all about. Well, obviously they wanted pro-trade union legislation and things like that, but they didn't claim to be socialist until
1918. And the Clause 4.
Right, thank you for the clarification there.
If it was the clarification.
It was. Oh. Missing something.
Anyone else?
Could I ask if we could just put in a few adverts while Keith's getting his breath.
An advert for Strange Meeting, Socialism and World War One. This is our new pamphlet. Yes, I'm coming to that one. This is £3. This is a reproduction of very interesting articles about the First World War, and it's by our party. £3 from over there. Our current issue of the Socialist Standard is also about the First World War. It's £1.50, and it's available from over there somewhere. It's got a very nice cover. If you're into... No, I'm not going to say. That's enough. That's enough. Thank you. That's my plugs.
I found the information when I came here a few days ago for the exhibition. I can't remember exactly where I saw it. I don't think it was in that book.
Yeah.
That pamphlet. Or was it in the Socialist Standard? But apparently two members of the party actually did join the armed forces.
Yeah.
And that was before conscription. And one was actually killed.
Yep. There were several, in fact, killed.
Yeah.
It's mentioned on the board.
Yes. Sorry.
So what's the reason you think why? They think they were carried away by the emotion, you know?
I think so, yes.
The Germans were doing in Belgium, for instance.
Yeah, I think they were carried away by the whole thing. They certainly joined against party rules.
Oh, yeah.
It was against the party rules, certainly, to join up. You would certainly, if you were conscripted,
you would be expected to do something about it. You were expected not to be conscripted. You would try to take some action against it. But if you were unable to, if they'd grabbed you by the collar and they'd marched you off down there, you know, there's a sort of certain leeway given to people like that. But basically, you were expected not to be to accept conscription lightly and to just join up. I've actually pointed out that these were disgraces to the party, and they should have known better. They should have been aware of things. You can make an exception. I think I didn't want to victimise. I think Adam actually objected to what I wrote there, because he was implying that I was saying that the general worker, the general working class, were very, very stupid to be in that, like Mr. I was being a Rudolf Rocker there and saying, well, if you don't accept the revolution, you've just got to go away and fight that war and die. But actually what I was pointing out was that for a socialist to join up, and especially to fight, that was a very, very stupid thing to do. And obviously their political education was not sufficient.
Yes.
Objection.
Keith.
Yeah.
You know, I've had a few problems with that myself. Seeing, I mean, with hindsight, it's so easy. But when you're in the position of a war that has never ever happened before, it's the first time that you're having an experience that, you know, is just so incredible. And, you know, you've got most people, I'm not saying I'm there at the time, but I can understand it a bit. You've got to eat, you've got to feed your children, you've got to keep a roof over your head. It's just like today when America is offering the youngsters in America, come and see the world, we'll give you an education, and sending them off to here and there and killing them off. You think you're going to better yourself. Plus, you've got that jingoism of the time, a word that we don't use now. You know, white feathers being thrown at you to show you're a coward. Wives and family saying, get out there and do your bit, etc., etc. It was very difficult for a member of the working class in that time, living in abject poverty, to not say, I'm going to put food in my belly and my children's and go off to war.
Well, if I could just make one point, is that actually it wasn't putting food in the bellies of their children, because a lot of the children actually went hungry. And this is something that I'll just make a plug for Sylvia Pankhurst here. This is what got Sylvia Pankhurst off of the suffragette streak that was going on and got her involved in social issues, because a lot of the guys who'd gone off from East London you know, basically the women and the children were hungry. So yes, you can say, yeah, you can get, yeah, like, you know, I think there's a, what I'm making a distinction here is I'm making a distinction between the working class and class conscious socialists. And we are expected to do a different thing. We're supposed to have different behaviour. We're supposed to know better, basically. You can make a lot of excuses for the working class in general, and that I think that's fair. I think that's a fair thing to say, is that, you know, you can get carried away with jingoism, because I hate to say patronising, but you don't know any better. I certainly didn't know any better, especially when I was an 18-year-old. I would have been quite willing to go off for the Falklands when I was, admittedly, I was too young for it. But I was, you know, oh, the Falklands, we must defend that. But, you know, and the other thing I would say is that there had been, you know, there had been things like this. The Boer War was a very similar case. People had been involved in that. It was only, you know, it was only 10 dozen years before that they had the Boer War. Many of the same people were, you know, involved in the campaigns against it. So you did have precedents. And initially, the First World War looked like being a European version of the Boer War. It would be something that was short and sweet, though, of course, the Boer War wasn't actually that short and it wasn't that sweet. But it was it seemed like a similar case. And I think, yeah, the people of the day did, you know, reacted in the same way. So, you know, you did have precedents there. And, you know, I think I make a lot of excuses for ordinary members of the working class, ordinary members, extraordinary members, as Danny would say. Yeah. So, you know, I make excuses for people who didn't know better, but for class conscious socialists, I'm naming and shaming them.
Understood. Thank you for
your comrades and friends, thank you for the collection of £21.50. Before we break and have refreshments, are there any other points, any other discussion, questions?
Very good talk, very pleasing now.
You want to round up, Pete?
What? Well, no, I love doing talks, so I am going to thank you for coming along, but also for being there, because I just love talking, as you can guess.
Just one more question.
Yeah.
Before the war actually broke out, before it was declared, a matter of days before that, in Trafalgar Square, there were demonstrations, were there? And there was this attitude that there was going to be a general strike, not only in this country, in other countries, to stop the possible war happening.
Yeah, and we were something there. You can see that's in Trafalgar Square, so on the big lions. So it's an interesting.
No, this is before the war. So
yeah. So this is June and July days, possibly slightly into August. Keir Hardie is there, and lots of people are listening to him, apparently. But I think it's easy to get carried away with what's going on, and I think that's what happened. Before the war, it seemed like we could stop it, and it could be, not by people, in the same way as the Iraq war could not be stopped by a demonstration of a damn sight more than that. We had, you know, there was, what, a million people?
Millions.
It certainly seemed like it when the Iraq war was going. And you don't stop wars by demonstrations. Sorry, that was a bit negative, wasn't it, there? That's a very interesting question. And something I would like to do a dissertation about, perhaps a talk at some point, the changeover between the cloth cap and the boater. The boater was actually the summer wear it was acceptable working class summer wear.
Yes.
No, not of the rich people, of the working class too. You were allowed to wear a boater.
They'd have been members of the clerical classes, the clerical section of the working class, probably up for the day from somewhere like Camberwell, you know, out to enjoy themselves at a jolly good outing. Trafalgar Square.
So you think they were only only listening to him? They weren't actually supporting him?
Difficult to say. I wouldn't like to hazard a guess.
No, there's certainly research being undertaken as we speak into the genuine working class of reaction to the outbreak of war. The argument is that you hear about the enthusiasm, you don't hear so much about the opposition, because it's not as colourful. There's no banners, no people in straw boaters and Panamas. History undergraduates are researching resistance to the outbreak of war in places like Halifax and towns up north, the industrial working class.